This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we talk with a Port Townsend resident who has gone to Nepal to help with earthquake relief efforts in the country where he grew up. And we learn how it was a passion for penny farthing bicycles that made American roads safe for the automobile. So now let's go inside the Compass. Reverberations from the magnitude 7.8 earthquake that devastated the impoverished Himalayan nation of Nepal a couple of weeks ago reached all the way around the planet and shook lives right here in Port Townsend. And at least one local resident set off last week to see what he could do to help friends in crisis in the country where he grew up. 69-year-old Richard Friedrichs was first taken to Nepal when he was 7. His father had been hired as an expeditionary doctor for a team that was sent to study the birds of Nepal for the Chicago Natural History Museum, and ended up staying for decades to found two hospitals, one in the central Nepal village of Tonsen and the other in Kathmandu. Friedrichs grew up there and has been returning regularly all of his life. I caught up with Friedrichs last week as he was preparing for his departure.
How long have you been in Port Townsend?
We first came here in 1980. My wife's family is here. Dave and Julie McCullough run the Elevated Ice Cream Company. That's my wife is David's sister.
So everybody's favorite ice cream place right in town. So your own connection to Nepal, I gather, continues to this day.
It does. I went there when I was 7. And then by when I was 9, I started going to boarding school in India. So I'd come back to Nepal on holidays and right through graduating from high school. I went to Woodstock School in India.
So have you been in contact with friends in Nepal?
Yeah. We have to wait day for night, so they're just waking up now in Nepal. So we've been getting messages that I sent last night or this morning for them. And
did you lose any friends?
No, actually, everybody that we know there, except for maybe one or two people that we haven't been able to get in touch with, are all okay, and we assume that they're okay as well, because they're not in the area that was affected.
So what kinds of things are you doing? I hear you're planning to go there.
Yeah, I'm leaving on Tuesday with a group called Crisis Relief International. They're sponsoring us. But it's a group of 4 firefighters from Portland Fire. And I'm going as a translator. Because one of the firemen is my son, David, who graduated from Port Townsend High School.
Oh, really? Now, has he spent time there?
He spent time there as a child from age 4 to 14. Then we came back and he finished high school here in Port Townsend.
How old were you when you moved away?
Well, I was 18 when I came back to the States for college, and then my wife and I and two of our kids, David the oldest and Ethan, went to Nepal in 1980. We spent 10 years there, and then our daughter was born there. And then since about 2000, I've been living in Hong Kong, and I started to go back to Nepal frequently after that. So I've been going, the last few years, I've been going twice a year.
For what purpose?
I worked at the Hong Kong International School, and I took a group of students into Nepal for a week, trekking and visiting schools.
So what kinds of experiences are your friends having in Nepal right now? Are they in trouble? Well, are they doing fine?
The ones that I'm in contact with are busy doing all they can to get food and shelter to some of the villages in the area. My closest friend in Nepal is Kiran Tresta, who's with the Rotary Club in Pokhara. And he's organizing with other Rotary groups in Nepal and internationally to get funding to buy supplies to send out into the districts that are affected. And what we're going to do is go to Pokhara and connect with him and some other groups that are doing the same thing out of Pokhara. And there's a group of people who had companies for tourists for paragliding and rafting and trekking and things like that based in Pokhara. And they're the ones with with their own jeeps and vehicles, so they can transport this stuff. And they've got great organizational skills, so they're organizing a lot of people to do this. And we're going to be arriving, you know, about a week after the earthquake, a little bit more, and they're going to be kind of exhausted by then, so we're going to try to step in and...
So you got the relief crew coming in.
Give a new boost of energy, hopefully.
Maybe things have changed in Nepal since I was there in 1987. Mm-hmm. But you talked about roads, and as I recall, there just weren't many. That, you know, like most places you went to in Nepal, you walked there.
That's right.
And I've been reading in the newspapers about, you know, like all these landslides on the roads between villages. And I'm wondering if they're using the term roads rather loosely or if they've actually managed to build a whole network of roads that I didn't know about.
Yeah, in the last 10 years, they've actually built a lot of roads, but they're jeepable roads. Or what they had was these tractor things. They have a big wheel in the front and a big engine, and they can pull a trailer on it. They're actually Chinese-made or Indian-made tractors like that. And they're the ones that go out from the main roads to the villages. And almost every major village has a road to it, or did until the earthquake, all over Nepal. So they bulldoze these really scary paths that are not really jeepable, but these other vehicles can get there.
So your friends have been involved in like bringing food and supplies into villages and not been involved in sort of like trying to fix roads or that sort of thing.
No, that's, you need heavy equipment for that. And that's being used closer to the Kathmandu. Keeping the main roads open is a big...
Right. So if there's like 10 slides between villages, I mean, what are they doing to get supplies from point A to point B? I mean, you know, if they can't take their jeeps and so on across there.
Well, people are coming down from the villages. And if there are people still back there, then some people carry the things back to their own villages. Because I know that they're setting up supply centers in different parts of the districts, and the villagers are coming there to get supplies. So if they know that they're there. So that's the kind of thing we're going to do, keep those supply centers supplied. And if we can, we hope to get into some of the villages and help build shelters. But most likely we'll be doing kind of refugee shelter things with tarps and tents because people are beginning to come out of the mountains. There's nothing left for them in the mountains anymore. Their homes are destroyed. Their animals are dead. And they can't plant.
Animals were killed as well?
Yeah.
I guess the animals were not outside.
Well, some were inside. Even the ones who were outside were grazing, and landslides have wiped them out or something like that. Rocks falling from the mountains above. The helicopters flying around the area say that when they look down at villages, sometimes they see no people at all, but they see carcasses of animals laying around. So it looks like in some areas people have already abandoned their villages.
Wow, it's really a disaster of sort of biblical proportions.
It really is.
Like, yeah. So what are you taking with you?
I don't know the extent of it, but we're taking water filters. It's called a Sawyer filter. It fits into the bottom of a bucket, like with a tap. So you can pour water in the bucket and then a tap, and the water that flows out is filtered. Mm. So we're taking a bunch of those. Taking tarps, food, MREs, you know, the some of those, ropes. I'm not sure what else. The firefighters in Portland are working all that out.
Mm-hmm. And are you carrying all of this stuff as hand luggage onto the planes? Are you shipping stuff separately? How are you doing it?
I think CRI is working out a deal with airlines. The airlines. We're flying Alaska to Vancouver and then China Air to Guangzhou and then Guangzhou to Kathmandu. So they're trying to work out. Alaska's okay with, you know, just taking it for us, but I think we're going to have to pay for the China Air to take it.
And how about the airfares? Are the airlines working with you on that?
We've raised some of the money ourselves, but part of it's going to come out of pocket. We've raised money through a website called Tilt. We have about 6,000-7,000 through that.
Is that like a crowdsourcing website like Indiegogo or Kickstarter? I see.
Yeah.
So this is something that you've obviously sort of organized with friends and family yourself. Are you aware of any other sort of like organized effort that's coming out of Port Townsend right now?
I know that the Rotary Club is raising money. They're going to send it to the Rotary Club in Pokhara, and it should get there about the time that I do. And so that those funds will be available for us to purchase things to take out to the rural areas. Other than that, I haven't heard of anybody.
I know that like one of the concerns there always is with disasters like this is going someplace and winding up as a burden yourself somehow, especially when, you know, food and medicine resources are scarce. So have you thought about that?
Yeah, we're depending. When we're out in the village areas, we're depending on MREs. So we'll feed ourselves. We're taking tents. And
so you're bringing your own food.
We're bringing our own food. Yeah. In Pokhara itself, there doesn't appear to be any shortages.
They're, I guess, sort of out of it, right?
Mm-hmm. Even though the epicenter was closer to Pokhara than Kathmandu, all the damage was from the epicenter eastward. And all the aftershocks were eastward of that place, too. So Pokhara didn't get nearly as badly damaged as Kathmandu and some of the other places.
How about your father's original hospital? How was that?
That's fine, too. It's south,
and that village?
South of Pokhara. The village is okay, too.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Are people seeking out places like that where there's hospitals? I mean, I know that the hospitals in Kathmandu are overwhelmed, right? So are people like going out to those other outlying places that were not badly affected and getting medical care there?
Yeah, the hospitals in Pokhara and Tansan are... There's places where helicopters are airlifting people, and they've already reached capacity. So I don't know. I guess they'll just have to, you know, take care of as many as they can bring there.
Mm-hmm. So have you decided how long you're going to stay?
We're staying in the 2 weeks. So we have return flights on the 19th, I think.
Well, I hope you'll report back when you return.
I hope so, too.
Since my interview with Friedrichs, the government of Nepal has requested that the many search and rescue teams that rushed in from around the world to help find survivors buried under rubble now leave the country to open the way for the more urgent current need for efforts like that of CRI to erect shelters and get food and medical supplies where they're needed. The United Nations reported last week that international aid to the beset nation has thus far fallen woefully short, with receipts as of last Friday of only $22 million out of the $415 million for which it initially appealed, or about 5%. In addition to the Rotary Club, the local Habitat for Humanity is raising money to help with Habitat's effort to distribute 20,000 emergency shelter kits in Nepal and to send engineering assistance to the country. Habitat guarantees that 100% of all donations earmarked for Nepal will go towards the relief effort. Donations can be made to Habitat for Humanity of East Jefferson County, P.O. Box 658, Port Townsend, Washington, 98368. That's Habitat for Humanity of East Jefferson County, P.O. Box 658, Port Townsend, Washington, 98368. This is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Compass. May is National Bike Month, in honor of which fact, this week KPTZ Compass is rebroadcasting a portion of an interview we did a couple of years ago with Gabriel and Sarah Chrisman, better known around Port Townsend as the Victorian couple. The Chrismans have a passion for all things Victorian. They dress in Victorian clothing, and their modest Victorian home in Uptown is entirely furnished in proper period fashion. On prominent display in the small parlor at the front of the house are a pair of original penny farthing bicycles from the Victorian era, those curious contraptions with the enormous front wheel and tiny rear wheel that appear impossible to mount, much less ride. These are Gabriel Chrisman's pride and joy.
This is an 1885 Columbia Expert, and this is an 1887 Singer Challenge. So we have a British bike and an American bike.
Challenge is probably a good name for these. I mean, it must have been difficult to learn to ride one of those.
Yeah, it was. But that was part of the point. These were a physical challenge, and they were impressive. most of the places that sold the bike would also make a big point of including lessons with the price of the bike. And the lessons would often be indoors. So they would have an indoor cycle place where they would teach you how to ride, and then only then you'd venture out onto the streets. It was very new. It was the first time when bicycles were really popular and were, you know, again, for a specific group of people. These were especially for athletic young men, and they were pretty expensive when things started out, and so it was definitely a way that you could demonstrate.
Like, how much would they cost?
So this one, the British bike here, was about $125, and the American one about $110. And
what would a weekly wage for, say, a stock clerk have been at that time? Any idea?
It's certainly, this would have been something close. I mean, again, it's hard to calculate, but probably for someone who was in that sort of position, sort of a lower level position, this might have represented 8 or 9 months' wages.
This is quite costly.
Yeah, this is very costly. And so the people, and I don't know, I don't have any history on this one as to who owned it or...
That's the British one, the Challenge.
That's the British one. But the American one here, I was lucky enough to buy from a family who had owned it since it was new. So it was the great-grandfather's bike. And so I know who owned this one. And it's a great window onto the sort of people who did ride these. And so this one he purchased... when he was 18 years old and had just gone off to college. He went to college at MIT, and he studied engineering. And later in life, he became the president of an electrical company. So this is when electricity was very new, and wrote a book on building hydroelectric dams that ran power plants and things like that. So he would have seen himself, I'm sure, as a very progressive, and being into engineering, this was something which was a great way to demonstrate that interest and to sort of show it off. But it's really, that one is too big for me to ride. It's a 58-inch diameter wheel, and that's, you need a long enough leg to reach down half the wheel size.
The other one is substantially shorter, actually.
This one's a 52-inch wheel. Okay. And so that's, for someone who's my height, about 5'10", 52-inch was a common size. The bigger the wheel, the faster you can go, of course.
Now, were you really looking for one of these when you found it?
Yeah, you have to be looking for these. They're hard to find. I was very lucky to find this one just in someone's garage. That doesn't happen very frequently anymore because people tend to know...
They weren't advertising for sale? Stumbled upon it?
Yeah, my wife and I have interests in antique clothing. And
I've noticed that.
Yes, and we do presentations on that. And quite frequently people want us to look at something they've got and give them an idea of what they have, maybe when it's from. And so someone asked me over to her house after one of these presentations to take a look at her great-grandmother's wedding dress. And she also said, oh, I have this in the garage you might be interested in seeing. And I was very interested in seeing it and told them if they ever wanted to sell it to let me know. And they thought about it, and you know, they thought it would be better for it to get restored, used, researched, all of that. And so they sold it to me.
Now, Sarah was telling me a little bit the other day about what you have to go through to get a new tire for one of these.
Ah, yes. I could show you all the tools and the materials that it takes. I've been learning this myself. Basically, the tires are hard rubber. And there's a wire that runs through the center of the hard rubber. There's a little hole in the middle of the rubber extrusion. And you have to cut the rubber a little longer than the circumference of the wheel. And then run the wire through the rubber. So there's some tug of war involved in getting the wire.
I'm sorry, so there is rubber made specifically for this purpose?
There are two people in the U.S. who have this rubber made by rubber companies. They sort of worked out what the extrusion needed to be, and then they have these places... reproduce it for them on sort of limited run basis. And it's not easy to find, and they're sometimes out of it because they're just one person and the market isn't big. But now I have a pile of it upstairs.
No, but this was not the original technique, I understand.
Right. There's three or four different techniques, and this is the modern technique. The original technique was you cut the rubber shorter than the circumference, you melted the ends of the rubber together, then you filled the rim with flakes of glue, and that was a glue that was horse-based. It was animal-based glue. And then you'd stretch the tire on over the glue, then you'd use a torch to heat the whole rim all the way around until the glue bubbled out around the rubber, and you'd let it dry that way. And first, it's, well, I don't know where to find, you know, flaked horse glue. someone does know that, you know, they can let me know where that is. But second is that the other part is that very few people would really trust glue and melted rubber to hold on. And if the tire does come off one of these bikes while you're riding, it is a very unpleasant thing to have happen. If it comes off, it then gets wrapped around the wheel because you don't stop rolling just because the tire starts coming off. Oh. So it gets jammed in. Then I've seen pictures and videos of it happening to people.
Oh, so this is not personal experience.
This is not personal experience. I have never had a tire come off. I have had tires loosen up on me, and it gets scary for a moment or two. And then I realize I have to redo it.
Now you say that bikes used to come with training to learn to ride them, but since there's not manufacturers anymore, there's probably not like a formal penny farthing training.
Well, the good news is that there are other people who are into these, and there is such a thing effectively as a little training apprenticeship. And someone who knows will teach you. And that's, in this case, I have a very nice friend in town who knows, and he taught me. He was nice enough to let me ride one of his bikes. And very carefully do what has come down to us as being the correct process for learning how to ride one. And it's taken me, I've been riding them now for almost 2 years. And it took me really a year to be comfortable riding around town in traffic and with traffic lights and people and bumps and hills and things like that.
How many skinned knees or sprained ankles did you experience in the process of learning?
Not too many, which is good. I've had exactly 2 falls. One the first day I was riding, and one very recently, actually.
Penny Farthing, it's a funny name. Where did it come from? Do we know?
That's actually a name that came out for these after they were popular. So it was sort of a derogatory term that people used for them by the time they were obsolete. And the reason that they called them that was because the size of the wheels was sort of the same differential roughly as between a penny and a farthing in English coins. The penny was large, the farthing was small. At the time when these were popular, which is about 1878 to 1890, they were actually called an ordinary bicycle.
And when did what we would call an ordinary bicycle come along?
Well, that's not an ordinary bicycle. That's a safety.
Yes. So safety bicycles, they first came along in 1885, a bicycle called the Rover. And it wasn't terribly popular at that time. The major change that made safeties work and made everyone want them was the pneumatic tire. And that was really about 1890. And pneumatic tires made safeties work. Because the problem is when you have a solid tire, you need the big wheel to help cushion the blow and make it a more comfortable ride. When you put it on smaller wheels, it was a very jarring feel. And so it was harder to ride. And they didn't roll over bumps as well with solid rubber on smaller wheels. And there were lots of bumps in the roads.
Was the evolution gradual? I mean, did the front tire slowly get smaller as the rear one got larger, or was it just all at once? They just said, oh, we'll make them the same size.
It was pretty much all at once. You know, they had, some of the safeties had a wheel in the front that was 2 inches bigger than the wheel in the back. But it was just sort of just like that.
So the chain drive was obviously another evolution that was important.
They had had chain drives in the 1870s and 80s, and they had used them on the tricycles. But the thing was that these bicycles, again, were for the sort of athletic people who wanted to show off, and they wanted it was a demonstration of your skill and your wealth and a whole bunch of other things. And part of the attitude was, well, the chain drive is heavy, it's inefficient, it introduces noise.
Yeah,
it's inelegant. Why would you want that if you were going out to be a real enthusiast on one of these bicycles? These things, when they're tuned correctly and they're all set up, they're utterly silent. And that's part of the magic of these, is that you don't have anything that will betray your presence until you want to make yourself known. So you can sneak up on people, you can cruise along and just not be thinking about these rattles and things like that.
Which brings us back to the roads. And the bicycle played such a pivotal role in the roads of America. I think it's definitely worth bringing that up. Because, do you want to tell the story?
Sure.
Okay.
So the people who were riding these most of the time in the 1880s were the wealthy, influential people in the community. They were the professionals, they were the judge, the doctor, the lawyer, the professor, the, in many cases, the minister, which is interesting.
So the doctor would be riding this, carrying his kit?
These weren't really written for what we'd think of as work or commuting. Oh. These were written almost exclusively for fun. And you would wear appropriate gear and things like that. And that's why they were used for touring and distance riding. And occasionally they were used for carrying messages, things like that. But mostly these were written by and very visibly by these very influential people who got together in social clubs that were bicycle clubs that were sort of a combination of a sports team and a fraternal organization. So picture the Rotarians or the Masons, except all on these. And riding in formation in uniform, blowing bugle calls to tell them, you know, when to form up or get off or, you know, what to do. And these were organized and highly influential groups of people who were prominent in the community. And they were advocating for good roads so that they could ride more and enjoy their hobby. And also they then promoted how it would be good for everything else. It would be good for commerce, it would be good for transportation, it would be good for everyone, not just them. And so this is the start of what got called the Good Roads Movement, and then became taken up by the people with Model Ts and such, you know, a couple decades down the line.
But the car could never have gotten off the ground if the bicyclist had not paved the road just a few years earlier. And if the wheelman had not already and very recently gotten those roads paved, there would have been no point to making the car because it wouldn't have been able to drive on the roads that had existed up until that point. So roads were made for bicycles, not cars, and a lot of people forget that.
Well, presumably there would have been some popular support from wagon drivers.
They backed up the wheelman, but it was the wheelman who did it. Because the roads had been in existence for hundreds and thousands of years up until that point in very bad shape. And in many countries, they still were. And the magazines of the 19th century would actually show photographs comparing roads in one country where the wheelman had encouraged the roads to be improved versus a road in a different country where the wagons were mired in the bog. And so what the wheelmen were doing was very beneficial for the wagoneers, and they appreciated it, and they realized the utility of it and took up the cause as well. But it was not them who did it.
Was there a sort of like the AAA of like cyclists back then? I mean, an association, a formal club that people belonged to?
There were two. There was one in America. That was the League of American Wheelmen, the LAW. And in England, there was the CTC, or Cycle Touring Club. And both of those were organizations that, yeah, they would be very much like AAA. They not only did they advocate for bicycles and all of that, but they printed maps. They provided information on roads and hotels and things like that. It was very much like AAA. But they also did things that AAA doesn't do. They, for instance, would approach weaving mills, and they had bicycle cloth woven specifically for bicycle outfits. One of the interesting things, if you read one of these articles from the Cycle Touring Club or from the League of American Wheelmen about an area, so they're sending riders out into an area that hadn't really been ridden in before, and they would write back this sort of travelogue of exactly where they went and how the roads were and what happened and what hotels they were in and what people were like. And actually, they're really well modeled on other popular exploring books from the period. If you read Livingston and Stanley's guides about touring in Africa, they do exactly the same thing. And the wheelmen and such were treating this almost as if they were doing an exploration into darkest Africa and finding out what the conditions were like and how to get about in these places and what you need in order to make it happen. And so people who were interested in cycling in those areas were almost conceiving themselves as performing an exploration of some sort. And the first circumnavigation of the globe by bicycle was on one of these bikes. And
so who was the first person to cycle the globe?
Thomas Stevens. So he has a great book called Around the World on a Bicycle that he wrote about that expedition, and it's really fascinating to read through.
What year was that?
That was 1884, I believe, that he did the ride, and I think the book was published 1885.
With Gabriel and Sarah Chrisman and their antique bicycles, this is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. The Compass airs Mondays and Saturdays at noon, Tuesdays at 5 p.m., and Wednesdays at 10 a.m., exclusively here on KPTZ, the home of eclectic, authentic community radio. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.